C, and D. And so these four-point functions emit conformal block decompositions. And the conformal bootstrap says that this four-point function should be invariant under crossing symmetry, which exchanges these points and these operators. So as a picture, the program says that this equation is true. And so there are OPE coefficients at these vertices, and so the relation of these two expansions of the correlator relate the OPE coefficients, and this is meant to place constraints on possible CFTs. So this has been a very productive line of thought over the past few years, especially, although this goes back to the 80s. So in most cases, one needs to truncate this problem because it's an infinite dimensional problem. Each side of this equation generically involves an infinite number of exchanges. And so typically, people resort to numerics or some sort of truncation, and this is very productive. So it'd be very nice to do something analytic where one didn't have to do that. And so there are various settings in which this has been done already. So to mention a couple, large N, large spin, where the operators have some spin, which is becoming large, or if one has supersymmetry. So these are just a few. Okay, so today I'm going to add one to this list, and this applies in two dimensions, although it might have applications in higher dimensions. And so the one I want to add to this list is the idea of holomorphy in 2D CFT. So in particular, if one looks at correlators of holomorphic operators, then this becomes a finite dimensional problem, and one can essentially solve the problem to come up with an infinite number of constraints among OPE coefficients of higher and lower dimensional operators. And so this leads to a very efficient algorithm for computing correlators of holomorphic operators. So in 2D CFT, a holomorphic operator is a current or a descendant of a current. And so one can think of this as a very efficient way of packaging the consequences of word identities for four-point functions. There's been some precedent in the literature before, but I think we'll help to present a more streamlined and somewhat comprehensive approach. And I'll mention references as appropriate later on. So this has some likeness to the construction of, say, other holomorphic functions in physics. So for example, if one has a 2D CFT, which is chiral, so it just has chiral or holomorphic operators, then the construction of its torus partition function, say, is highly constrained, and in particular, it's must be a polynomial in the J function, which is this famous modular function. And so I'll show later on that this problem of solving the bootstrap for the holomorphic case of holomorphic operators not only has a likeness to that approach, but actually can be literally mapped into the construction of torus partition functions. And this will provide us with a nice source of intuition. So that's all. That's its own story. But as an application of what one can do with these ideas, we'll turn to the 3D gravity side. So if one looks at 3D quantum gravity at genus 2, as I will in this talk, one can use these results to efficiently calculate the semi-classical expansion of the partition function around a given saddle point of genus 2. So where did this connection come from? How does this work? Well, in 2D CFT, suppose one wants to compute a partition function on some genus 2 Riemann surface. So I can draw it, I'll be schematic here, as a sphere with two handles. Okay, so I want to compute the CFT partition function on this particular Riemann surface with some marking, etc. And this can be recast by the so-called sewing construction as a sum over four-point functions of local operators in the CFT on the sphere. So there's some weighting factor here. Again, I'm just being very schematic for now. So this is the statement of the sewing construction, and the idea is that one allows the states of the Hilbert space to propagate through these handles, and then you can replace the handles by a sum over all such operators with various weighting factors, and there's some formalism here, but this is a well-established idea. So you see that if you want to compute four-point functions well, rather, if you want to compute this object in terms of four-point functions, well, this is how you do it. And so coming up with an efficient way to compute four-point functions is applicable in this setting. Okay. In particular, suppose you want to compute just a certain part of this partition function, which applies in any CFT. So any CFT has an identity representation. So this includes the stress tensor and all of its Virasoro descendants. So these live in the vacuum sector of the Hilbert space. And so I might call this particular contribution to the genus 2 partition function zvac. So this is a natural object to compute. It's universal in the sense I just described. And this actually, by idea CFT, maps to the bulk partition function on some genus 2 3 manifold, which I think of as filling in this genus 2 Riemann surface here. So this is some manifold M such that its conformal boundary equals this guy. And so this idea was articulated at genus 1 first in various papers in the 2000s, but at genus 2 and higher was articulated concisely by Yin. And so this is a correspondence between an object in CFT and an object in the bulk. And so the power of this idea is that one can compute this from CFT, compute this for arbitrary central charge, and then expand it in 1 over C. Now, in ADS3 CFT2, the central charge of the CFT is related to the Newton's constant in the bulk, like so. So this is the sort of result of Brown-Hanault. And so you see the 1 over C expansion maps to the semi-classical expansion of the bulk partition function around this particular saddle point. So why is this interesting? So at genus 1, there are various puzzles in 3D gravity that have yet to be fully resolved. One interesting feature of 3D gravity at genus 1 is that if you look at the partition function expanded around a given saddle point, say empty ADS, then you find that actually it is one loop exact in this semi-classical expansion. And I'll explain this a bit more later. One might wonder whether at higher genus there's a similar statement. And in fact, there's a calculation in the CFT that's been done for a particular Riemann surface corresponding to the computation of a Reni entropy in 2D CFT that suggests that this might be true. And this would be rather remarkable, and it might give you hope that you could actually compute the full bulk partition function as a sum over all such saddle point contributions if you actually knew the seed partition function around a given saddle to all orders in 1 over C. But it turns out the upshot is that there's no truncation, and so I think this is a question that deserves further study. And so finally, time permitting, you might ask, okay, what about more general four-point functions in 2D CFT? What can be said about this? And so the central object in computing these is the Virasoro conformal block. And this is an object that we don't understand nearly well enough. It emits a series expansion for which we know its coefficients in closed form. But one might hope to do some sort of resummation of this. And I'll show you that actually by using these Zamolodchikov recursion relations for this object, one can actually resum some of the coordinate dependence in this object, and this is to be regarded as a step toward a full understanding of this as some type of special function. So that's the plan. Good. So of course, questions welcome at any time. Good. Okay. So we're going to start in the 2D CFT side. So consider some primaries in the 2D CFT, which I'll denote O sub A. Okay, and so these you know, have some, in general, are not holomorphic. Okay, so there's some dependence on both Z and Z bar. But I'll sort of suppress the Z bar dependence for simplicity. And soon enough, we'll specialize to holomorphic operators anyway. Okay, so these generally have some OPE. Plus descendants. So these are the three-point function coefficients. These are the fundamental ingredients in the perturbative sector of the theory. And there's some metric on the space of two-point functions, the Zamolodchikov metric. This. Okay. So if one writes down a four-point function, you can write it in some sort of OPE expansion. So let's do that. So we have a four-point function of four arbitrary, say, primary operators. And so you can write it as some power law piece out front. Times some function of the cross ratios x and x bar, where x is just, in this case, you can define it, say, as this particular ratio of positions. So here, z12 is z1 minus z2, etc. Good. So this admits a conformal block expansion. So this is the object that we want to constrain. This is just some piece we are free to pull out front. So our goal is to constrain that guy. Okay, so if we look at the conformal block decomposition of this object, so it's a sum over, you know, operators E. If we expand this in the channel where A goes to B, so this FABCD is a sum over OP coefficients times VR-Sorow blocks, if these are primaries. So here I denote a VR-Sorow block by curly F, and it's a function of the central charge, the external dimensions, the internal dimension, HE, and the cross ratio. Okay, so here I'm expanding in the in this channel. All right, good. So in general, this has some series expansion. So the start set x to the HE times a sum, an infinite sum, of coefficients which depend on the central charge and dimensions. But we'd like to know more about this object. Okay. So to simplify the problem, first we're going to just look at chiral operators. Okay. So what does that require of us? That just means that if I take these all to be chiral, say, quasi-primaries, then there's no z-bar dependence. So I can just erase these guys here. And I can take f to just be a function of x. OK. So the goal is to constrain this guy. Now, chiral operators have zero right moving dimension, and we take the left moving dimension to be, say, integral. Just for simplicity here, you can make it half integral, that's okay. And so, good. So this is the setup. So now we use crossing symmetry. Crossing symmetry says that the full correlator is invariant under permutations of these operators. So if we start permuting things, then this will transform in some simple way. And then we ask how f has to transform. And these will be our crossing equations. So let me just be explicit about this, because the manipulations are quite easy to follow. So if we permute operators 1 and 4, then one can show that this function f obeys the following. Okay, so there's some overall factor of x, where I take capital H to be the sum over all of the dimensions HA through HD. And there's this prefactor here. And then the function f is evaluated at 1 over x instead of x, with A and D permuted, because I changed operators 1 and 4. Likewise, if I change the position of operators 2 and 4, then this equals something similar, where now this takes x to 1 minus x with some prefactor. So let's get that right. These are our crossing equations. Any questions so far? It's all straightforward, I think. Good. So now comes the key part. All right. So, first of all, this function fabcd is a rational function. It has poles when operators collide, namely at 1 and infinity in this case, and these poles are of finite order. Okay, we can actually read these off from here. So say when x goes to infinity, right? This has a pole of order ha plus hd, but this piece is finite. Because as x goes to 0, for example, so if you take, if you sort of look back here, when you take x to 0, that means that operators 1 and 2, or a and b, rather, are colliding, and this is finite in that limit. So when we take x to infinity, this is finite. This diverges with a pole of order ha plus hd. So that tells us what the order of the pole is at infinity. If you take x to 1, well, this again is finite. It admits some series expansion. And now the poles of order hb plus hc. If you take x to 0, it's finite. So now we're looking for the unique rational function that has this polar structure and the right behavior when x goes to 0. We couldn't make such a strong statement if this were not a holomorphic function, but it is. So that's the point. So we're looking to uniquely fix this function using its poles. And you see from this crossing equation here, we can just read off the relevant polar pieces and put them all together in the right way. So as x goes to 0, this behaves, so the leading piece of the identity, if it's possible to be exchanged. So you have a goes to b and c goes to d. And then you have some higher order pieces that vanish as x goes to 0. So here's the constant piece. This is the contribution from the identity to that four-point function. So now let's look as x goes to infinity. So what happens here? Well, we expand this in a conformal Bloch decomposition. And again, this is going to be finite. So all we have to do is pick out the polar pieces. And so you see that the leading pole goes like ha plus hd. And so you're going to get terms of order x to the ha plus hd all the way down to, well, 0, and then nonpolar pieces. So we can write this as follows. Sorry, that might be a little too small. Let me write that. So some coefficients, alpha n, xn, plus nonpolar pieces. And these alpha n's, you just read off by series expanding the conformal blocks. And so there's some explicit expression for this in terms of OPE coefficients. In particular, it's quadratic in the OPE coefficients. And there's just some combinatoric, some factors from the hypergeometric functions. Likewise, when x goes to 1, you can write a similar sum. So now there are terms, some beta n. These are quadratic in the OPE coefficients again. And so there are some polar pieces and there are some nonpolar pieces. Okay. Good. So this is all we need to write down the function f in terms of these coefficients completely. So the result, putting things together, is that this function f equals the polar parts from infinity plus the polar parts from 1 . Now when we take x to 0, we have to make sure this has the right behavior. So this term vanishes. This goes to 1. So we subtract 1 here. And we add the piece from the S channel where the identity is exchanged. And that's the final answer. So we've determined this in terms of H coefficients, alpha n and beta n, okay, where H is just, again, the sum of all the dimensions. And the point here is that H is less than infinity. So generically, you'd think that the four-point function is fixed by an infinite number of exchanges. And indeed, an infinite number of exchanges do take place. The point is just that the OP coefficients of the operators with dimension greater than the larger of these two guys are fixed completely by the lower dimensional operators being exchanged. So an analogy, as I alluded to earlier, is in the construction of some CFT partition function on the torus for a chiral CFT, where there, one just needs to fix the polar parts in the Q expansion, and then the rest of it comes for free by writing it in terms of the J function, or alternatively by invoking the Rademacher expansion of a holomorphic function on the upper half plane. So this is quite similar, and in fact, this becomes literally what one is doing when one takes the four operators to be identical, which I will do now. Okay, good. So if one takes all the operators to be identical, then we don't need any indices on this function. We just call it some f of x. This is not the same thing as the conformal block. So I'll distinguish them by their arguments. Mostly I won't really talk about this until later. So in this case, there are further symmetries because the operators are identical. So you can actually determine the four-point function in terms of fewer pieces of data. So let's see how this works. So the following is a somewhat slick way to get the final answer. So if one considers some function g of x, which is just the following combination, so it's this function f of x times these prefactors in x, where h is the dimension of the operator whose correlated we're computing. Okay. And the statement is that actually this function g of x is actually invariant under the crossing transformations up to this phase. Okay. So what we're looking for is a function that's invariant under the so-called anharmonic group, which is isomorphic to S3, which permutes 0, 1, and infinity. Okay. And furthermore, so G is S3 invariant up to this phase. And furthermore, it has poles of order 4h over 3 at x equals 0, 1, and infinity. So in this parameterization, the correlator is just this function g of x divided by x over 1 minus x to the 2h over 3. Okay. So it treats all the points symmetrically. So what we need to do is find a function that has this invariance property in these poles. And so this is not hard to do. So if one considers the following function, which I'll call j, so j of x equals this guy here. This is invariant under S3, and it has poles of order 2 at all of these points. So we just need to take the appropriate power and take linear combinations of these, and that determines g entirely. All right, and it's a finite sum because we only have poles at these points, and so we don't have poles, for example, at the zeros of the numerator. So if we were to have negative powers of this appearing in the definition of g, this would be inconsistent with the physical input. So the final upshot is that g of x can be written in the following way. So it's written as an overall power of j to the 2h over 3. This gives up the right leading pole. And then there's a finite set of terms that we multiply this by, and it stops at the integer part of 2h over 3. If this kept going, there would be poles at e to the I plus or minus pi over 3, but there shouldn't be because we're computing a correlator that has no poles there. Okay. Good. Let me leave this here. So any questions about this so far? Okay. So there's an analogy with the construction of modular functions, and I think it's fun to flesh this out. So if we take our cross ratio x, and we just equate it with the so-called modular lambda function, which is some not a modular function, but it's invariant under some subgroup of the modular group. This has some Q expansion. Where Q is related to the variable in the upper half plane in the usual way. So what's the point of doing this? Well, what this does is it induces a map from the four punctured sphere, where we have our four operators. So the moduli space of the four punctured sphere I can write as M0, 4, so that's the genus, and that's the number of marked points. This makes a map to the upper half plane, and the torus, which is the genus 1 surface with no marked points. Okay. So, in particular, SL2Z transformations on this guy induce anharmonic group transformations on this guy. So the crossing equations can be cast in terms of an SL2Z transformation. So in particular, if one takes tau to minus 1 over tau, then lambda goes to 1 minus lambda. This is our one of the crossing transformations that we used before. And if we take the TST transformation, which is tau goes to tau over tau plus 1, then lambda goes to 1 over lambda. Okay. So SL2Z transformations on tau induce anharmonic group transformations on x. And so what we need to do is think of this four-point function as a holomorphic function on the upper half plane with prescribed poles. Okay, and so you might not be surprised to find that actually the function I called j of x before, when you equate x with the modular lambda function, this is just 1 over 256 times the famous j function in terms of tau. Okay, so this is a modular function. This is just a statement that j of x was invariant under the crossing transformations. And so the construction of g, the four-point function, really boils down to the construction of some polynomial, basically, in J with the right poles. Okay, this is really just like constructing a torus partition function for some chiral CFT. So there's some nice intuition that comes from that. So it's useful to sort of make a table. So on this side, we have the coordinate x, and that sort of maps to lambda of tau, which has some Q expansion. So I don't mean this in some literal way. Okay. And so here, the J function I wrote over there is really the J function, which deserves the name. So in this language, what corresponds to a conformal block? Well, that over here corresponds to a character. So to make that a bit clear, when we take our piece of the four-point function and rewrite it as to the 2h over 3 times the sum over these constants times j to the minus n. Then we can write this in terms of conformal blocks as well, right? So we have some OPE coefficients, which I'll just write as CE squared, so some squared OPE coefficients, times some conformal blocks corresponding to the exchange or some operator with dimension HE. Okay. So over here, the statement is that if you write your torus partition function as a sum over some constants BN times the J function, so there's some polynomial here, then you should also, you must be able to rewrite this in terms of characters weighted by some degeneracy for that primary at level H. Okay. So you see the correspondence here is between the blocks and the characters and the degeneracies and the OPE coefficients. So, for example, we know that in the CFT, these degeneracies must be positive, and actually they have to be integral. And that maps to the condition over here that the squared OPE coefficients must be positive. So this is unitarity in this case. Okay, and that's sort of a different form of unitarity. So there's more one can say here. So for example, there's a Rademacher expansion for the terms of large dimension in this expansion. And that basically says that the terms that are nonpolar are fixed in terms of the polar pieces. And likewise here, one can constrain the OPE coefficients of very high dimension operators, or any operator at all above the poles, by looking at the OPE coefficients below. And there's some very precise formula for this due to Rademacher. And the Cardy formula is an approximation to this. So one can say that there's a Cardy formula for OPE coefficients in the correlators of chiral operators. So I think there's probably more that can be said here. And in fact, there's more that has been said in the past. So when one actually computes this, what does one do? So I neglected to mention that, OK, what are these constants? So these are just, you obtain these by expanding this at small x and reading off the OPE coefficients at the first several levels, right? So for example, if h equals 2, you can compute the stress tensor four-point function, for example, using this method. So that actually means you just have to compute two coefficients here. And since j, when you take x to 0, j goes like 1 over x squared, this means that there's basically there are two coefficients you have to compute, c0 and c1. And c0 just corresponds to the exchange of the identity. And c1 just corresponds to the exchange of the operators at level 2, which is, say, the stress tensor. So all one has to do is compute the OP coefficients from these two guys, and then this fixes the whole result. Right. So suppose you didn't actually know these OP coefficients, and you wanted to ask what is allowed, what is consistent. This would allow you to constrain the possible chiral algebras that a given theory could have, because these conformal blocks come with a certain prescribed structure in their dependence on the central charge. And these coefficients over here need to reproduce that structure. So for example, people like Bauknecht and Watts and Blumenhagen and others use these kinds of ideas, albeit a little less comprehensively, I'd say, to constrain the possible W algebras. So for example, there's a statement that if you want to write down a W algebra with an operator of spin 2, the stress tensor, and some other operator of spin S, but nothing else, then you can only do this for generic central charge when that S equals 4 or 6. Otherwise, there are not enough coefficients over here to match the required structure in the central charge of the conformal block expansion. Okay, so I think there's more to be said about this, but that's a bit of a historical reference for that. So let's move to the gravity part of things. So, So before talking about genus 2, I think it's important to review some of the story of what we know about 3D gravity at genus 1. So
let's do that.
So suppose one wants to compute the bulk path integral. Let's write this as z grav. One can compute this as a ordinary path integral, integrating over all metrics, which asymptote to a torus at conformal infinity. So this is not straightforward to actually do. So 3D gravity has various solutions. So the smooth solutions, so we have some torus at infinity and it's filled in the bulk. Okay. So the smooth solutions are empty ADS or thermal ADS and its modular images under SL2Z. So this torus is labeled by some, so there are two. There's a contractible and there's a non-contractible cycle. Different tori depend on how I label these two cycles. And so the path integral should sum over all such saddle points which differ by non-trivial SL2Z transformations. So this is supposed to be equal to some sum over modular images of the partition function on the solid torus, namely thermal ADS, where gamma is some element of SL2Z, and I mod out by some elements here, so I'm just going to put an asterisk and not get into the details of that. And so this is a reasonable assumption about what solution should be included. For example, there are conical defect solutions. These are not smooth. And if one decides not to include these, then the sum is just this sort of relatively simple sum that one has to perform. So it's still an infinite dimensional sum. And assuming some natural regularization, one does this, and one does not get a partition function that could possibly be that of a dual CFT, for example, because the degeneracies are not positive integers, nor is it a discrete spectrum. So this goes back to Witten and then Maloney and Witten and others. So this is not a universal object. What I'm computing here is the path integral of pure 3D gravity, given some assumptions, and it appears to give something we don't understand. So you can look at the seed partition function that corresponds to a given saddle point, say just some ADS with some fixed choice of contractible cycle. And this is a universal object, actually. Instead of trying to compute the full path integral of 3D gravity, one can actually just look at the partition function around a given saddle point and perturbative fluctuations thereabout. And this actually does map to something in the CFT. Namely, it maps to the vacuum character. So the partition function around thermal ADS with some complex structure tau equals the vacuum character of any CFT with the right central charge. So we can write that in terms of the Hue expansion like this. This will be sort of important in a second. And so here we use the fact that this describes the vacuum representation, this counts the states in the vacuum representation of any CFT, where the central charge C is just given by the Brown-Hanault value 3R over 2G. So this correspondence has nothing to do with what the true dual of 3D gravity is. It's just a piece of the full path integral that makes sense in CFT language. And all it relies upon is this semi-microscopic use of ADS CFT as describing the current sector of any CFT with the right central charge. So you might notice that this has a very simple C dependence. In particular, if one computes the free energy, F, is minus log of Z thermal ADS, that there's an order C piece, an order C to the zero piece, and nothing else. So the 1 over C expansion in the bulk maps to the semi-classical expansion in small g Newton. And so for some reason, this truncates at one loop. So this is a statement of one loop exactness, which was first written down by Maloney and Witten. And so one might wonder, First of all, sort of on a deep level, why this happens. There's some idiot-CFT understanding of this, and there's sort of a pure bulk understanding in terms of just quantizing phase space, but I would say we don't truly deeply, at the deepest level, understand why this truncation takes place. So one might wonder whether when one goes to higher genus, something similar occurs. And in 2D CFT, it's very natural to go to higher genus because it's believed that if one can construct the higher genus partition function for a given CFT, this specifies the CFT fully. So let's talk about that. Now let's go to genus 2. So again, the full bulk partition function is going to be something complicated. You have to sum over all saddle points. And when you go beyond genus 1, there are solutions that are a bit sort of messy, so to speak. So we're interested in computing the saddle point partition function around some 3-manifold with genus 2. In particular, I'm going to look at a handle body. This is the simplest type of manifold you encounter in the situation, which basically models the handle body as a quotient of H3 by a discrete subgroup of the group of Mobius transformations known as the Schottky group. Okay, so this means that the boundary of Riemann surface is some quotient of the plane by the Schottky group, and this is a particularly simple construction of the Riemann surface. So we want to compute this. Now, computing this to all orders in some semi-classical expansion in the bulk would be very hard. You have to compute loops. And in general, no one works beyond one loop in the bulk doing anything because it's hard to do. So as I alluded to in the introduction, we're going to compute this from CFT by using the Sewing construction. And the question we'd like to answer in particular is the free energy defined as minus log z around a given saddle point is it exact at some order in the 1 over c expansion? So you might think, okay, well, you didn't tell us much about why this happens at genus 1, so why would this be true at genus 2? It turns out there's actually a 2D CFT calculation that hints that this might have been true. So in particular, there are certain Riemann surfaces that are relevant for computing Rani entropies, where you have two intervals on the plane in the vacuum, and you can construct the so-called replica manifold, and you have to compute the partition function on this manifold, and the Rani entropy is very simply related to this free energy. So this calculation was done in some sort of perturbative expansion where the intervals are very short and far apart. And the result to the order to which this calculation was done by Bin Chen and collaborators suggested that actually when you take the surface to be genus 2, this truncates. So this was a bit intriguing. But as I already said, this actually does not take place. And this was just an artifact of their perturbative expansion. So now we can sort of finally connect to an application of the bootstrap. So we want to compute this vacuum partition function in the CFT on some genus 2 Riemann surface, which I'll draw like this. So these handles have some Schottky coordinates, P1 and P2. You can think of these as parameterizing the width of these handles. And if I fix 3 coordinates on the sphere and leave the fourth one, call it x, free, then these are the 3 complex moduli of this genus 2 Riemann surface. And the Sewing construction says, replace this by a sum over operators, which live specifically in the vacuum part of the Hilbert space. Where we perform an expansion in P1 and P2. This is just part of the inherent mechanics of the Stellian construction. So insert operator OI, 0 and infinity, where this handle was, and operators OJ at x and 1. And the conjecture, originally due to Yin, is that zvac on this surface, which we'll call sigma, is equal to the saddle point partition function on the handle body M, whose boundary is sigma. Good. So we can use the analytic bootstrap results from before, which just gives us a very efficient way to compute correlators of chiral operators, because every operator sitting in the vacuum part of the Hilbert space is a chiral operator. It's just the stress tensor, normal order products of the stress tensor, derivatives, and so on. So it's not really a direct application. I mean, it's an application, but they're not logically sort of tied at the hip. Right? But this just gives us a very efficient way to compute this. And some of this has been computed before in this work by Yin that I alluded to. But if you look at his paper, for example, you'll find that you cannot he did not compute to high enough loop order to test this conjecture. So with our techniques, we can do that rather easily. And it turns out that there is no truncation. So not only that, but perhaps more excitingly, one can actually give explicit expressions for all loop contributions to the gravitational partition function around one of these handle bodies, which is a calculation that would be quite hard to do in the bulk. Indeed, the computation of zvac in CFT is done for arbitrary central charge, and so one should really view that result as valid for finite C. So this is a truly quantum result from the gravity perspective. So let me write down one of those terms, just to give the explicit expression. So, good. So there's no truncation. And in particular, if we expand this vacuum free energy due to the Virasoro identity representation alone in some loop expansion in powers of C, then we can give some expressions for these guys at some fixed order in the P1, P2 expansion, where P1 and P2 are the widths of those handles. Okay. So it's perturbative in that sense, but it's exact in X, where X was the coordinate on the sphere. And the reason we can write down an expression exact in X is because we had this very efficient way to compute these correlators for all X that didn't rely on some conformal block expansion in small x. So, for example, beyond three loops, for all loops beyond three loops, there is a piece of the vacuum free energy, which we compute to be this. So you might recognize some of these structures from before. Here are the same kinds of structures that appear in these correlators. So here are the powers of P1 and P2, and then there's just some object that we expand in 1 over C. Okay. Good. So it would be very nice to understand results like this directly from the bulk, for example, in terms of some diagrammatic arguments, but it's quite hard to do this. Better yet would be to actually do something using the Trin-Simons approach to 3D gravity. This is actually true at genus 1 as well. The calculation of the partition function at genus 1 has never been done from that approach. But it seems very natural because it builds in the fact that gravity is topological, because there's no propagating degrees of freedom in 3D gravity. And so it seems that the Trin-Simons approach would naturally spit out something that was one loop exact, given that we already know that at genus 1 this is true. But the problem is that to compute this object, we need to compute the partition function on a non-compact space with a non-compact gauge group, because 3D gravity in Trin-Simons formulation can be written in terms of two copies of SL2R Trin-Simons. And the technology for this doesn't yet exist. But it'd be very nice to do this, and I think it would be very enlightening in terms of how we think about 3D gravity in general. So I've got about 8 minutes or something. So any questions before I sort of change gears a little bit to close? Okay. So with the remaining time, I'm going to zoom out and we'll put gravity aside once more and return to the world of four-point functions. And now we can think about four-point functions of non-holomorphic arbitrary operators in 2D CFT. So the central object here is the conformal block. And as I alluded to before, we only understand aspects of this object. So the conformal block is contribution of some primary, which now I'll label as P for primary, to a four-point function and all of its conformal descendants. And here when I say conformal block, I mean Virasoro block. So we understand the global blocks in two dimensions, just as we do in all even dimensions, which is to say we have some closed form expression for it, resummed in terms of a hypergeometric function. But the Virasoro block involves an infinite sum over all such global blocks. And so here I have in mind that the Virasoro algebra is an SL2R subalgebra. And this is the chiral half of the global conformal symmetry SO2,2. Okay. So this means that the Virasoro block gets branched into SL2R blocks, and since this is infinite dimensional, it's an infinite dimensional sum. Okay. So if we write the Virasoro block as I did before, it's a function of central charge, external and internal dimensions, and the cross ratio x. So we have a series expansion for this. And this is due to, well, it was inspired first by the AGT correspondence and then later proved by Alba et al. In 2009 or 10, I think. So these coefficients are known in closed form in terms of some combinatoric expression in 4D gauge theory type variables. So that's a relatively recent development. But one would like to do a bit better than this, for example, to resum some of this x dependence, ultimately resumming everything and understandings in terms of some special function, say. That seems a bit difficult. In the meantime, it would be nice to understand the conformal block, or the global conformal block decomposition of this guy. So due to this, there's a branching of the block, as I said. So you can write this block as a sum from q equals 0 up to infinity of some coefficients chi sub q, which are functions of the parameters, times the global conformal block corresponding to the exchange of some quasi-primary operator, where a quasi-primary you can think of as primary with respect to the global subalgebra. So that block explicitly is just this hypergeometric function. And this piece here corresponds to the exchange of some level q descendant of the primary p. Okay. So this coefficient chi q is a sum over all squared OP coefficients of all level q descendants of the primary OP. Okay, so in general, it involves a finite sum over all the level q descendants of some primary. Okay. So for example, level 2, you have the stress tensor. Okay, and that's it. So this would be some thing quadratic in the dimensions. Right? So we'd like to derive this object here. That would be quite an improvement over this, because it resums an infinite piece of this infinite x expansion into global blocks. Right. So I won't be able to go into some of the details of how one can do that, but it turns out one can do that. I come up with a closed form expression for these guys. Okay. And so just to sort of outline where this comes from and how one can get to this point, and then I'll conclude. So there is a recursion relation due to Zamolodchikov for the generic Virasoro block. This is the most efficient way to compute the series expansion to any fixed order in X. But the recursion relation has some nice structure, and one can examine the structure and see if there's a nice pattern to it, and evaluate this guy in closed form. So I will just sort of write down the recursion relation, motivate its structure, and then I'll have to conclude. So the block here is written as, so if we write this global block, if we just shorten that into some little f of HQ, okay. So the Virasoro block is given in terms of the global block to the exchange of the primary itself, plus an infinite sum over terms that have poles in C. So the idea here is that one thinks of the block as an analytic function of C with all of their parameters fixed. And the block has poles at values of the central charge where some level mn descendant of the primary OP becomes null. So when it becomes null, its norm goes to zero, and this object has poles. Okay. These poles have some residue, and this residue must be proportional to the conformal block, the Virasoro conformal block, of the null state and all of its Virasoro descendants. The idea there is that you have some module, right? So you have some primary up here, and then a bunch of Virasoro descendants. Okay, this is obviously nothing true to life here. But the point is that if one of these descendants becomes null, that means it becomes a primary. And so it would contribute to the conformal block with its own conformal block, because it's a primary. And so all of these states here become null. So the residue at this value of the central charge, where this state becomes null for this value of the intermediate dimension, is proportional to the block for that state. So the residue involves the conformal block, the Virasoro conformal block, evaluated at this degenerate central charge. The same external dimensions. The internal dimension shifted by mn, because it's the operator of this dimension, which is becoming null. And of course, x. And there's some prefactor here, some residue, which is labeled by these indices m and n. And this is a function of the external and internal dimension of the primary. So you see that this is a recursion relation, because as you iterate it, you plug the same formula back in for this guy, and you keep going and going. And every time you do that, the power of x increases, because the power of x with which this global conformal block starts is increasing due to the fact that you shift the internal dimension by mn every time. So if you expand this in small x, it's a very efficient way to determine the series expansion of the block. But the point is that if you expand this out iteratively to the first several levels, you see there's a nice pattern emerging. And the dimension at each level of the iteration shifts by some sum over the mn's at the previous levels. And the central charge is given by this degenerate central charge of the block at the previous level. So using this structure, one can actually come up with a closed form expression for this guy. And this gives a global decomposition of the Virasoro block in closed form, and formally at least eliminates the need for a recursion. So that is the story with that. I'm happy to say more post-talk, but I'm running into the end, so I should just conclude. Let me mention a few of open questions in all of this bootstrap conformal block 3D gravity realm. So in the world of the 2D bootstrap, I'm definitely of the opinion that there's more to be done analytically. And so I think, for example, more analytic bounds on the dimensions and the OPE coefficients of chiral operators are in the offing. As I said, there's been some previous work on this, but I think it's time to revisit that a bit more systematically with some new approaches. And I think there's more to be said here. And it'd be nice to extend these observations to non-chiral operators, although that's obviously a harder problem. And I should just mention that, so in the world of conformal blocks, this sort of solution can be easily expanded in 1 over C, because you see from this recursion relation that the large C limit just involves the first level of the recursion, because after the first level, I replace the central charge with some degenerate central charge. So when I take C large, all that matters is the first level. Anyway, if that was a bit too quick, it doesn't matter too much. So the idea is that the 1 over C expansion of this global solution to the Virasoro block nicely maps to the question of scattering amplitudes in ADS3, say, for example, of 4 light particles. You can imagine computing this from CFT by appropriately putting the right conformal blocks together with the right coefficients and expanding that in 1 over C. So for example, this would correspond to the 1 over C term of the appropriate linear combination of Virasoro blocks that correspond to this Witten diagram. And that relationship is not one-to-one, unfortunately, but we do understand something about it. And so I think there's some potential to derive expressions for sort of quantum effects in scattering in ADS3 by using a bit more of what we know about the Virasoro blocks. So with that, I will conclude. Thanks.
Do you have some comments about the non-chiral story? What ideas could eventually extend there? Because most of them seem that it would be very hard.
I agree, yeah. I mean, I have no great ideas at this moment. I would say that... So one thing that I'm sure you're aware of is that there are these correspondences between 4 and 6 dimensional superconformal field theories. Sectors of those theories where you take BPS operators and you compute their 4-point functions, you can map this to a problem in 2D chiral algebra. Now, I think those, so far what they've done, they know everything they need to know about the relevant 2D chiral algebra correlators. So what I've said so far does not directly apply to that pursuit, but I think that when it comes to questions of classification, there might be some overlap. But in terms of direct 2D CFT non-chiral bootstrap, no, I think that nothing I've talked about today can directly be applied. However, I think that this point about there being sort of a Cardy formula for the growth of OPE coefficients for high dimension operators, that's something that I think might generalize in some sense, because it just relies on asymptotics of the global blocks. And so I think that approach can be applied in that setting, although that's sort of work in progress.
It's not, it's them.